The Business of Marketing podcast is brought to you by Demand Exchange. Demand Exchange provides the technology, content, and expertise to identify and acquire your next ideal customer. Season 3, Episode 7 features Henry Skelsey, Vice President of Product Marketing at SongTrader, in conversation with Justin Cook, Chairman of Demand Exchange.
I am delighted to be joined here at the Business Marketing Recorded Live Advertising Week by Henry from SongTrader. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Excited to be here.
Introduce yourself.
So I'm Henry Skelsey. I'm the Vice President of Product Marketing for SongTrader Group. In my role, I oversee all our enterprise technology products and increasingly our creative services products as we bring them into a more, call it, off-the-shelf offering.
Okay, so SongTrader, for those that don't know it, which I'm sure is very few people left on the planet, but for those that don't, why do you exist and what problems do you solve?
That's a great question. So SongTrader is a music solutions provider for businesses, agencies, rights holders, musicians, and fans. And what that means is, you know, whatever a music problem you have, be it choosing the right song for your next holiday campaign, composing your Sonic logo, understanding your Sonic brand identity, trying to capture your Sonic essence as it is exposed to your customers, or conversely, on the rights holder musician side, trying to find ways to better capture the value of your rights holdings, or as a musician, really make sure that you're being paid appropriately and that your music is being marketed correctly to the world.
Wow. So give me the story. How did it all begin and kind of where are you now? So that's the bookend.
So we started about 10 years ago. Our founder's name is Paul Wilshire, who is a very successful musician and music producer in his own right. And the thesis of the original company was to help independent musicians better manage their music in the new digital age. As we grew, we expanded beyond just individual musicians into labels. And then Paul saw a real opportunity throughout the music space to start acquiring companies that would help with that mission. And the mission really is maximizing the value of music for all. And so we've grown through, you know, several aggressive acquisitions. We've made 11 acquisitions over the last, I believe, 8 years across the music space from creative services. We acquired several firms, one named Massive Music, who some of our European listeners may be familiar with. Acquired a firm called Big Sync Music, a firm called Resonance in Australia. We've acquired a music AI company called MusicCube out of Germany. And most recently, what people probably, you know, when they first became familiar with us, we acquired Bandcamp almost exactly a year ago.
Wow. That's impressive.
And so if you're not familiar with Bandcamp, I always like to give it a little spiel. Bandcamp is the world's leading e-commerce marketplace for independent musicians, their music, and their merch. And so our goal with Bandcamp is to empower independent musicians to really achieve the career with their music they want to achieve.
And size that for me in terms of where you are today. Here we are, it's like it's, you know, kind of October 2024. Like, what's your reach? What's your breadth? Size, scale?
Yeah, so we work with quite literally the largest brands in the world now. The example I always use is we designed the TikTok sound, the sound end of every video that you hear on TikTok. That sound came from us. So we worked, our team in London worked very closely with the TikTok team to really capture their essence. And is now, I believe, the most heard sound in human history.
That's incredible. I love that. That's you learn things every day. That's going to stay with me for the rest of my life. And you and your role, and give me your kind of career journey today.
Yeah, so I started actually in Asia. So my first real job was at Walmart China. So I helped launch the Sam's Club e-commerce business over there and then worked for Andrew Miles, who was the CEO of Sam's Club at the time, and helped him develop the 10-year Sam's Club strategy. Went to business school, was a management consultant for a few years, and then joined the tech world. And I've been bouncing around the tech space, both in B2B and B2C, doing a mix of growth strategy and marketing. So I joined SongTrader a little under 2 years ago with the goal of helping understand how we start consolidating these brands. So when I joined, we had, I believe, 8 brands in market, which is a lot to manage. There are some overlapping product lines. There are some overlapping identities. And so we've spent the last about 18 months really starting to understand how we bring those together. How do we simplify? How do we really clarify to the market? Particularly as we've continued to make acquisitions, we've made two in my time here, what we do and how we serve our customers best. And how every single one of these acquisitions is really additive to our overall mission. Literally the billion-dollar question, right? You'd be very honest, and you'd be very purposeful in your communication. And I would say that we haven't got it completely right yet, but we're working on it. And it's I have found that direct communication with our customers and with the market has tended to be the most effective in explaining how we can help. And what that means is we start the conversation by listening. So we make sure our salespeople, our executives, our marketers, physically in front of our potential customers as much as possible. When they're there, we make sure they're positioned to ask the right questions, and so they can really then understand what that individual customer needs. Building from there, we can then tailor our solutions. Now, as a product marketer, having a fully customized solution for every client is a product marketer's nightmare, very candidly, because it is very hard to then replicate and scale to the degree that we like to. And when we talk about growth marketing, replication and scale is the bread and butter. So once we've had those conversations, we've understood it, and we've had enough successful engagements, which we now have, we can start to draw out the individual, where the parallels between those engagements are, where the patterns are, and then what I come in and really help what we call productize it. So creating repeatable offerings that are scalable in a way that we can achieve the business goals we have.
Bring that to life for me. Give me some real world examples.
Absolutely. So a good offering that we're working on right now is what we call our Music IQ product. So we've had a research team internally for years and years, and what they typically do is when we bring on a client, they do a research study to understand that client's historic music use, and then how that use has translated into a sonic brand identity in the marketplace. A lot of brands have not gotten it right. Some have gotten very right. Some people are being fundamentally outcompeted. And what that means is once we have that data, we can then tailor their offering. Do they need a new sonic logo? Do they need a completely new music or sonic strategy? Do we just simply need to start custom composing a whole bunch of tracks for them? You get the idea. So that piece of work is fairly replicable. It's very straightforward. It tends to follow the same path. And so what we've then come to end is, okay, how do we, take our really great research team and create a really off-the-shelf product that we can say, okay, here is the set process, here is the steps we go through, here's how we bring through every client. We can now build an operational team off it. We can build an operational model. We have predictable both revenue and costs. And that then becomes a product that I can very easily market, in a straightforward manner with a clear narrative. It clearly falls into a schema with the rest of our product line, and everything fits together with a nice bow most of the time.
That's a great example. Tell me a little bit about the relationship between product marketing and sales.
It's a great question. So, product marketing is, I would say, it's a relatively newly defined field in marketing. It's been around, at least the term at least, has only been around for a handful of years. Now, product marketing has always existed. We just haven't carved it out specifically. I find product marketing sits in this unique place between the sales team and the product team, where we're really meant to be one of the key translation layers between the technical product managers who really understand what the features are, why they are creating them, what the ideal use case is, and the sales team who fundamentally can't or fundamentally doesn't have the time, not really can't, but fundamentally doesn't have the time to go into the level of detail they need to understand the product. And so we act as that translation layer. We help the product team really craft their narrative, their messaging, the material they need. We work with the sales team to understand what the market is telling them, what the customer response is, and we put it all together into both material the sales team can use and the training they need, and feedback that the product team can then use to inform their roadmaps.
And when you think about measuring effectiveness and setting kind of metrics, what is your kind of go-to set?
So it really depends, right? At the end of the day, our goal is almost always to drive profitable revenue. I say almost always, but so what we look at then is what are the leading metrics based on our current sales funnel that are most likely indicate that sales line or that sales opportunity is going to turn into not just revenue, but profitable revenue long term. And so, you know, we think about the concept of growth marketing, which is a term that really just means data-driven marketing. Are we actually measuring the things that we need to measure to make those informed decisions? Are we measuring, is, you know, the conversion rate from MQL to SQL a leading indicator? Is the speed through funnel a leading indicator? Is the number of conversations at certain venues? What has been a really interesting evolution of the marketing space in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, which I'm sure you hear from all your guests, is the amount of data that we're able to get. And the data, frankly, is not just, you know, click-through rates, the typical programmatic, but it's the data that you get from in-person interactions. And so we can now understand exactly if, assuming our sales team uses the CRM right, and they do, if we have a 30-person sales team at a major conference, if they have these kind of engagements with these classification of client, and we can dive down to a real nitty-gritty level what those clients are, what kind of engagements are, what are the most profitable uses of our sales team's time?
Wow.
Right? And then when we understand that, we can then start tailoring the material a little bit better. We can try again. We can optimize in real time. And you almost get the level of optimization that you have in the programmatic world then into the real world.
And to enable you to do that and to achieve your kind of full potential, what is now kind of inside the overarching SongTrader digital and technological stack?
Well, to be honest with you, we're still building it.
Yeah.
I would say the technological tools are not there yet to do it to that level. So a lot of this is unfortunately still somewhat manual.
Yep.
It's a lot of relationships I've cultivated with the sales team, the people on my team have cultivated with the sales team, making sure you're in constant, you know, real-time communication, tracking it ourselves where the tracking systems don't exist. You know, we use a major CRM like everybody else, making sure we're really using that to its full potential, and where it doesn't serve a purpose, fitting in either custom tools or, you know, hacks to get it to where we want it to be. But, you know, one of the things I've been really excited about with the advancement of AI in marketing is the potential for AI, the potential to unload a good deal of that analytics and reporting onto an automated system in a way that the current system space doesn't allow you to.
And how have you reacted and responded and, I suppose, in a sense, benefited from this rapid growth that you have as an organization, but also with that extra sort of challenge and complexity of then the acquisitions that you've seen in your tenure as a growth marketer, as a product marketer?
So that's it's an interesting question. So when we acquire a new company, so we acquired 7Digital, which was a British music streaming platform.
One of the original OGs, right?
Exactly. I've been around forever. They have an unbelievable amount of trust, and they have incredible brand equity. But they work in a space of the music industry that most people just don't think about. It is crucial. They underpin, frankly, if you walk through a mall or you listen to music on a streaming platform or you're on a social media outlet, odds are good that that music has come through 7Digital's pipes, right? They're that important to the overall digital music space. Because of that, you know, we've had to ensure that we don't then destroy the brand equity and trust they built. Because as an infrastructure company, the thing that is most important is that it works at whatever scale. It's going to work how they tell you it's going to work. It's going to report accurately to the rights holders, so the rights holders maintain the trust. It's going to do it safely. It's going to do it compliantly. And it's really maintaining that sense of trust. And so when we bring that into an overall brand schema, it forces an evolution on both sides. So it forces an evolution on the overall SongTrader brand, on the other brands we have in our portfolio, to be able to incorporate that level of trust. At the same time, it forces an evolution in the 7Digital brand that we very carefully manage into a schema of, hey, we brought this in. It's actually getting better because of the experts and expertise that the rest of these brands hold. So those services are now open to our clients, and the technology is just going to get better. And at the same time, SongTrader, you know, has a halo effect from that trust and from that technology that we can then build on as well.
And when you're integrating teams and so forth, what, you know, do you have a kind of fixed org structure that you kind of work to? If you do, would love to, I'm sure every marketer listening to this podcast would love to kind of find out kind of how you think about orging up and the sorts of roles that you like to have in your teams. And how do you then kind of reap the benefits of that acquisition and bringing new talented members of those organizations into your teams?
You know, organizational structure is one of those fascinating concepts that has been studied endlessly. And, you know, I would say that nobody has figured it out, you know, truly. But what we do is when people come in, we look at what they were doing previously, but more importantly, we look at their skill set, at their work, and frankly, their interests. So if somebody comes in that is a marketer that says, yeah, I've been doing this for years, but it's never been my passion, I'd really love to be back into this other part of the marketing world that I started my career at, that's an important learning, because you don't want people, particularly after an acquisition, you want people to stick around because they have the institutional knowledge you typically need, but then you want them to be really engaged and excited about this new opportunity. So how do we marry the needs of the overall organization with their wants and desires so they stay and are happy, the organization gets the outcome it needs and the business outcomes it needs to drive value from that acquisition, and then we drill a new culture, because culture is never going to stay static when you acquire a new company. There's going to be new inputs. It's going to evolve. And making sure that we're really careful about where that culture goes, I would say, is the most important one. But there's no box. There's no, hey, you have to reorganize your marketing team this way when you acquire a company to be successful. I don't think that exists. And I think, frankly, a lot of the problems caused after acquisitions is believing that there is a box you can just slot everybody into immediately.
And from, you mentioned skills there, and whether you think of this in a skills level or at a competency level or at a behaviors level, what do you kind of personally look for from the players in your team?
Curiosity. So I want people that have just this aggressive curiosity to understand why certain things happened, right? I don't want just you to say, okay, well, we got this, you know, use a very basic example. We have this click-through rate on our most recent email campaign. Great. You know, it was above benchmarks. It was above our goals. Fantastic win. I want you to just, that eat at you, to kind of niggle at the back of your brain so that then they say, okay, what happened? Why did this happen? Why, you know, what are the pieces that go into this that made our customers or our potential customers react this way? And just have that bother them enough that they're going to independently go and dig into it.
I love that. And that's a lovely segue into kind of my next kind of question around sort of that curiosity, I suppose, in a sense of and that sort of willingness to kind of experiment, mm-hmm. and, you know, and through that experiment challenge, you know, the norm, and this is how we've always done it. How do you kind of embed that in your kind of culture?
So multiple different ways. First, it has got to be a little bit top down, mm-hmm. because you have to show a willingness to allow mistakes, right? Experimentation doesn't work without the willingness to make mistakes, learn from them, and keep going. And with a willingness of leadership, and not just a willingness, but an aggressive push from leadership that, hey, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to do experiments that don't work. And that is just as important as experiments that do. And so being really credible in that statement makes your people comfortable with going out and trying to learn the things you need to learn to be successful. So I'd say that's absolutely step one, is creating that culture that mistakes are okay. That's easier said than done. Two is, once you have that, making sure your people are empowered and have the understanding of where it's worthwhile to test and where it's not. Right? And a lot of that goes back to making sure you are measuring the right metrics, so you're not just, the term in the U.S. at least is, you know, teaching to the test, mm-hmm. right? You're always going to do the actions that you measure. You're always going to optimize towards your measurements. So you having to be absolutely certain that the metrics that you are measuring are the ones that actually drive your business. And that, frankly, in a lot of cases, is the first experiment you should run. You know, are we measuring the right things? Are our metrics set up correctly? Is this, you know, if our business goals are to drive, you know, increase revenue by 25% in the next 2 years, are the metrics we're driving towards actually going to do that or not?
Can you give me some examples of that sort of experimentation in practice, and perhaps, you know, kind of like what you learned, what the impact was?
Sure. So, I mean, like everybody, we do constant A/B testing of landing pages. It's a very classic fail, very, very, you know, simplified. Now, the thing about SongTrader that's somewhat unique is none of our products are static. Every product we have is sonic, is music or sound, and so it's always attached to moving content, you know, maybe with the exception of overhead radio, but that's a customer of ours that provides it. And so how do we ensure that we're capturing that motion, that visual aesthetic for a product that fundamentally isn't? And it's been a lot of work testing both landing pages, social media content, our websites themselves, emails, you name it, to see what actually gets that message across that, hey, yes, this is just by the nature of being the unit that it is, this is not a super engaging unit, but we want you to either turn the sound on or we want you to understand what we're trying to tell you. Very complex. I don't think we've got it right yet, but we're getting closer and closer with every experiment we run.
It's fascinating. And when you mentioned email, tell me about sort of how you are running, whether it's multi-channel, omni-channel, however you want to call it, right? What are your kind of, the email I'm assuming is a surefire kind of steady bet. What else kind of from an activity and channel perspective are you deploying at the moment?
So I would actually say email for us is become less important.
Interesting.
Because we have, the majority of our business still is in the creative services.
Yeah.
And so that, when you think about really agency sales, it's very different than, say, a SaaS sales model, where it's still primarily relationship-based. It's based on your previous work. It's a lot of awareness marketing. It's a lot of what people think of what the ad groups do. For the SaaS products, as we launched those and scaled them up, we've started using more email. That being said, spray and pray has not worked. Being very targeted in our material, and then frankly, because of this just content overload world that we live in, being very purposeful in what we're sharing publicly so that people are actually willing to pay attention. And that's been very difficult. Typically, what we release are our major thought pieces. It's our major pieces of content that we've done for clients. It's awards, but it's the things that are going to have people stand up and listen and say, hey, okay, this is worth opening this email, or this is worth looking at the social media post and understanding what's going on, and could this work for my brand? It's the post we think will build that sense of empathy and understanding that, hey, we know what you are going through with your business because we've helped other clients do it and help other clients solve that problem. And therefore, we can help you. So helping clients and potential clients see themselves in the material we're putting out.
And here we are at Advertising Week, obviously. How important are events and bringing people together?
Extremely. Like I said, nothing we do is static. And what our offering, because of the acquisition and the breadth of products that we offer, is still a very complex narrative. So having the opportunity to sit down with people, understand their needs, and explain how we can help them has proven to be the number one way we make our sales. And so opportunities like Advertising Week and other major conferences, in-person events, we can get the message out. We can say that sound and music and sound is crucially important to your business. It's often the last thing thought about in a given advertising campaign. And we really argue it should be the first, because that is where you build the most powerful emotional connection to a brand.
I'm really glad. You must be reading my mind somehow, because you're kind of preempting my next kind of question. And the impact and power of audio on a brand, on experience, driving engagement. Give me kind of some of the science and the data to kind of back up that last statement you made.
So there's a statistic that every brand in our industry comes out with. It's that brands that you, and I'm going to probably misquoted here a little bit, but brands that use brand-aligned music consistently in their marketing are 96% more likely to be remembered than brands that don't. And that came out of a study, I believe, done by MasterCard 10 years ago when they launched their Sonic logo. And they were obviously, as people may know, the first major brand to really go forth with the Sonic logo and make some noise about it, pardon the pun. And so, hanging our hats on that, we've started launching what we call the Music Of series. So it's a series of research pieces around music use by brands in various industries. We did Music of Beauty, looking at the beauty industry. We did Music of Beer, looking at the beer industry. And recently we just launched Music of Sports Apparel. And what we do is we look at, in the Music of Sports Apparel, all the various brands that you know, Nike, Adidas, so on, the advertising they run and the music used in that advertising and how it's performed with audiences and how it's maintained or supported, most importantly, their brand identity. Do they have a consistent brand identity? Do they have consistent music use in it that supports that brand identity? Do they then drive recognition by potential customers or customers overall that, hey, I hear this kind of music, oh, that's Nike, or I hear this kind of music, that's Under Armour? And how do they then rank against their competition? And the findings, frankly, I won't give away the ending, but the findings actually may surprise some people, that the brands that you may think of being the best at this aren't necessarily always the case, because music has been, for many people, such an afterthought.
Really interesting. You mentioned you'd acquired an AI-based business. I have to ask you really a little bit about sort of how AI has impacted SongTrader, kind of how you're, you know, utilizing AI in the business and how you see that kind of playing out in the future.
So AI is crucially important. I think we can all agree to that. Where it is right now, I think globally, is you know, somewhat still of a party trick, but what's happening behind the scenes, you know, here at SongTrader, at other companies, is where I think the future is going to happen, right? So we acquired a company called MusicCube in 2019, and their technology ingests music, breaks it down to 4-second segments, and then analyzes those 4-second segments against an enormous amount of potential data points. These are, you know, music PhD level data points. These are things like genre and instrumentation and vocalist gender. And what that unlocks is a new level of understanding of a given track. So if we can classify every piece of music against that algorithm, in which we're doing, with full rights holder permission, and that's important, I'll come back to that, we can then enable a level of understanding, discovery, and search for our customers and for ourselves that hasn't existed, right? There are several hundred million pieces of music that have been digitized up until this point. It is almost impossible, if not impossible, to search through them all, right? Hundreds of millions of tracks. But what that means is there are an enormous amount of tracks that might be a better fit for certain pieces of content, or might be from artists that are just fundamentally outstanding that have never had the chance to be discovered. And that's the point we really care about, is helping those undiscovered artists, typically from underrepresented groups, be discovered, just because they're buried under this mountain of other content. So if we break down every track, we can then use our AI and our natural learning, natural language engine that we've also built, to basically say, hey, I need music for a snowboarding campaign targeting millennial women in the Northeast of, you know, upper middle income, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And using all the data that our AI has amassed, find the exact tracks that it think will best perform against that audience, against the channel you've chosen today. And so what that has done is basically said, hey, instead of just going back to the typical 15 tracks everybody uses, I now have a whole breadth of content I can discover from, and that may perform better for my brand. And that, you know, and in some cases, and in many cases, the mega tracks may still be the best. But it's opened a whole new world of content to me and to my brand and for use. And so when we think about brand identity, sonic DNA, really your how music is used in your brand, that then empowers you to find the musicians and partner with those artists that really, really emphasize the message you're trying to get across. Now, back on the rights holder point, this is something that you know, is really important to us. Because we were founded with the idea of helping musicians maximize the value of their music, right? Get fairly compensated for use online, and a lot of musicians still don't get fairly compensated. Everything we do with AI needs to be with the full, not just the full permission, but full support of those rights holders. And so when we ingest music, we do it after we've gotten the permission of the rights holders to, to just ingest it, analyze it, and then you use it in our search, right? Same thing with musicians. And so one of the big fears when we acquired Bandcamp was, oh, this is just going to be training data for your AI. And the thing that we, you know, have been trying to get across, and the thing that we want everyone to be sure of, is that's not the case, right? if, you know, we, our goal with Bandcamp is open up new opportunities for musicians to make better use of the content. If there is going to be, if there is an opportunity that for someone to use it in that case, we want to give that to you as a choice, never an obligation, that says, hey, this group wants to pay you for X and we'll help manage the transaction. We'll make sure you're protected. We'll make sure that your rights are protected. We'll make sure you're compensated fairly. But it'll never be an obligation. It'll always be a choice that you are making with full knowledge of what you're doing. And so that's really important to us.
It's the 20th anniversary of Advertising Week this year. You've been very busy. It's incredible to hear the growth and what you're achieving now. But let's just try and cast our minds forward. Another 20 years, we're sitting here in 2044. What does the ecosystem look like?
That is a tough question to answer.
Sorry.
No, it's a good one, though. I mean, you know, I'd be remiss not to mention how AI is going to transform everything, including marketing, right? I think that's obvious. How that's going to happen, we don't know. And anybody who tells you they do is, you know, full of it. We know that there's going to be more data, not less. We know that there's going to be better systems to analyze that data and make decisions. Whether those decisions will ultimately be made by artificial intelligence or humans, that remains to be seen. I believe it'll be a mixture of the two. But I think fundamentally, marketing, advertising, sales is always about human empathy, right? You're trying to build that empathetic connection with your customers. You're trying to make sure, you know, communicate that you understand their needs, and that's why you're bringing this product to them. That's why you're asking them to spend their valuable time to look at your product, understand it, and then hopefully purchase it. And I think it'd be very hard for technology will try and get in the way with it, but to successfully remove that. It's always going to go back to that human connection between the brand and the customer.
Henry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
The Business of Marketing podcast is brought to you by Demand Exchange. Demand Exchange provides the technology, content, and expertise to identify and acquire your next ideal customer.